We would like to send out a special thanks to Faherty for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Faherty is a family-run brand making high-quality, timeless clothing with modern design and functionality. Get 20% off your first purchase by going to FahertyBrand.com/cold with promo code COLD at checkout. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
Christmas Eve, 1924. Babs Switch, Oklahoma. A fire breaks out at a Christmas party taking place at a schoolhouse and claims the lives of 36 people. When the remains of one of the presumed victims, 3-year-old Mary Elizabeth Edens, cannot be found, her family believes she may have been abducted. Over 32 years later, evidence is found to suggest that a California woman named Grace Reynolds might be Mary, and she winds up having a reunion with the Edens family. However, in 1999, it is revealed that additional evidence was uncovered to show that Grace was not actually Mary after all, so no one knows what really happened to the missing child. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and for our final episode before the holidays, we're going to be covering an obscure but very unusual Christmas Eve mystery which took place nearly a century ago, the 1924 disappearance of 3-year-old Mary Elizabeth Edens. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Katie Stanko, the most recent winner of our Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Katie. This is a contest which we've been carrying on for over 4 years now, and if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, last month, I was searching for some holiday-themed mysteries to feature throughout the month of December, and came across a post at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit written by a poster named Boots Callahan, which captured my attention and introduced me to a case I had never heard of before. This story could almost be described as a cross between a pair of older missing persons cases which I've previously covered on The Trail Went Cold, the 1945 disappearance of the Sauter children, and the 1947 disappearance of Joan Gay Croft. As you might recall, the Sauter children were 5 siblings who all disappeared when their family's house burned down in West Virginia on Christmas Eve, and Joan Gay Croft was a 4-year-old girl who vanished shortly after her hometown of Woodward, Oklahoma, was hit with a devastating F5 tornado, as Joan was taken out of a hospital basement by a pair of unidentified men and never seen again. The backdrop for this particular case is a horribly tragic fire which occurred at a party in a 1-room schoolhouse in Babs Switch, Oklahoma, on Christmas Eve in 1924, and took the lives of 36 people, many of whom were children. But there was some ambiguity about the fate of Mary Elizabeth Edens, as her aunt was certain that she managed to get her out of the schoolhouse before it burned down and handed her off to someone else. Since there was no conclusive evidence that Mary died that night, her family suspected that she may have been the victim of an abduction, and sure enough, 3 decades later, they would reunite with a woman named Grace Reynolds, who managed to convince everyone that she was the now grown-up Mary and had been raised under a false identity. But by the end of the 20th century, evidence came out to show that Grace Reynolds was not who she appeared to be, so the case pretty much did a complete 360 and went from unsolved to solved back to unsolved all over again. So on this episode, we're going to try and figure out what actually happened to the real Mary Elizabeth Edens. Did she die in the fire after all? Or could someone else have taken advantage of the tragedy in order to abduct her? Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the decades-long saga of Mary Elizabeth Edens. Our story begins in 1924 in Babswich, Oklahoma, a small rural hamlet located in Kiowa County, about 6 miles outside the town of Hobart. Our central figure is 3-year-old Mary Elizabeth Edens, who lives on a farm with her parents, Lewis and Ethel Edens, as well as her 18-month infant sister, Etta. On Christmas Eve of that year, a night in which there was heavy snow and sub-zero temperatures, around 200 people attended a Christmas party at a local one-room schoolhouse. Lewis and Ethel brought Mary to the party, though their youngest child, Etta, was left at home to be watched by an uncle. Unfortunately, the schoolhouse was severely overcrowded, as the number of people in attendance far exceeded the building's 26 by 36 foot capacity. The party had a Christmas tree decorated with lighted candles and had presents hanging from the branches, which was a major fire hazard, and tragedy would occur sometime after 8:30 p.m. Dal Boulding, a 16-year-old student dressed as Santa Claus, reached in between the tree's branches to remove presents to give to the children, but this caused a couple of the lighted candles to fall over, and they immediately ignited some paper decorations, tinsel, dry needles, and stage curtains. While Dow and some other partygoers attempted to smother the fire, they accidentally knocked the tree over and caused the flames to spread. The schoolhouse was a light wood-frame building which offered no resistance to fire, and the ceiling had also been painted with flammable white oil paint, which caused a flashover. The kerosene lamps which were being used to light the building exploded from the heat, and the schoolhouse had no firefighting equipment or running water to douse the flames. Once the fire started consuming the building, everyone rushed to the schoolhouse's only door, but since the door only opened inwards, it wasn't long before the exit was jammed with people. Attempts were made to escape by breaking the windows, but they were all blocked with steel grating, which had been installed to prevent people from breaking into the schoolhouse, and the broken windows only created a draft which fed the flames. By the time all the survivors escaped the schoolhouse, the fire had taken the lives of 32 people and injured 37 others. The victims were all transported to Hobart, but 4 more people would ultimately succumb to their injuries, bringing the total number of deaths to 36, and sadly, half of the decedents were children. Dow Boulding, the teenager who accidentally knocked the candles off the Christmas tree, was killed in the fire, and his entire family was hit hard by the tragedy. He lost his 13-year-old sister Maggie and his 8-year-old brother Edward, and Dow's older brother Claude lost his fiancée Gladys Clemens, whom he was planning to marry on Christmas morning. Gladys Clemens also lost her 2 sisters, Mary Lois Clemens and Juanita Clemens Stevenson as well as her 3-year-old niece, Mary Juanita Stevenson. However, it was a family named Coffey who were hit the hardest, as a couple named Thomas and Beulah Coffey and their 4 children, Aubrey, Maud, Ethel, and Orly, were all killed in the fire, as well as Aubrey's fiancée, Vesta Jackson. Many of the victims were identified by their jewelry or other indestructible personal items that were found in the ashes, but 20 of the decedents were burned completely beyond recognition, and since it was impossible to determine which remains belonged to which person, these victims were all buried together side by side in 20 separate coffins in a long mass grave at Hobart Rose Cemetery. In response to the tragedy, the state of Oklahoma would pass a new bill which increased fire safety requirements for schools, as they were now all required to have a minimum of 2 doors which opened outwards. The usage of steel grating on windows and the placing of lit candles on trees would now be prohibited in public buildings, and since the Babswich fire received nationwide publicity, schools and public buildings from all over the country would follow Oklahoma's lead and implement stricter fire codes. The year after the fire, a new schoolhouse was built in Babswich at the original site, but it closed down for good in 1943. Today, the location is a memorial site with a stone monument featuring the names of all 36 of the victims. However, one name, Mary Elizabeth Edens, is absent from the monument, as she was officially classified as missing rather than deceased. After the fire ended, No one could find any trace of Mary at the scene, and she had last been seen sitting on the lamp of her aunt, Alice Noah. Even though the windows were blocked by steel grating, someone managed to pry one of the grates loose, so Alice managed to escape from the schoolhouse through a broken window. Alice suffered severe burns to her face and head, and after she was taken to the hospital, she died of smoke inhalation 2 days later. However, before she passed away, Alice claimed that when she escaped the building, she held Mary outside the open window and placed her in someone's arms. But Alice said she did not get a good look at the person she handed Mary to, and no one could figure out what happened to the child after that. Indeed, while many of the victims who were burned beyond recognition were identified by their jewelry, Mary had been wearing a ring and a locket that night, yet neither of these items could be found in the ashes. Technically, there was no conclusive proof that Mary was dead, but even though a search was performed of the surrounding area to explore the possibility that Mary might have wandered off, no trace of the child could be found. No one ever came forward to confirm that Alice had handed Mary to them through the open window, so the Edens family held out hope that this person might have taken Mary away from the scene and she was still alive somewhere. Over the next 3 decades, the Edens would spend a lot of money hiring private investigators to search for Mary, and they encountered a number of false leads. Virtually every year around Christmas, newspapers in Oklahoma would publish stories about the Babb Switch fire and make mention of Mary's disappearance, and this would sometimes lead to tips from people who suspected that someone they knew might be Mary. Unfortunately, whenever these people were tracked down and administered a blood test, the results would show that they were not related to the Edens family. However, during the fall of 1956, an accountant from San Bernardino, California named Elmont Place read an article about Mary's story in a magazine and became convinced that a friend of his named Grace Reynolds might be the missing child. Grace was in her mid-30s and was a divorced mother of 2 sons who lived in the town of Barstow, where she ran a dress shop. During past conversations with Elmont, Grace had told him that she was passed around between different families throughout her childhood and never felt a connection with her birth mother, so she wondered if she might have had a past she did not know about. Since Elmont was the district governor of the San Bernardino Lions Club, he decided to get in touch with the president of the Lions Club in Hobart, Oklahoma, to see if he could contact Mary's younger sister, Betty, who was living in the area. Betty was not born until after Mary went missing, but in an interesting parallel to Grace, Betty's married name happened to be Reynolds. And yet another odd coincidence, Betty and Grace each had a son named Lewis, the same name as Mary's father. Given that Mary's parents had already experienced a number of disappointing false leads when finding people who turned out not to be their missing daughter, Betty did not want to tell them about Grace Reynolds until a thorough investigation could be performed. Betty and her other sister, Etta, compared photographs of Mary to existing pictures of Grace as a child and thought there was a striking resemblance. In fact, Grace even had one photo of herself which had the name Mary inexplicably written on it, and she recalled that her foster parents had once attempted to take it away from her. Grace also had a small scar on the arch of her right foot, which matched a scar Mary once received on the same foot when she fell from a bed. There were other unique similarities, as a woman who knew Grace as a child said she had been very fond of bacon rinds, and one of Mary's aunts recalled an incident where she snatched bacon rinds from Mary's hand and told them they were bad for her. But most importantly, when a blood test was performed on Grace, it showed that she had the same blood type as the rest of the Edens family. Betty and Etta became convinced that Grace was their missing sister and informed their parents that Mary had been found alive. On February the 9th, 1957, Grace traveled to Oklahoma and had an official reunion with Lewis and Ethel Edens, who had not seen their daughter in over 32 years. The story wound up garnering nationwide publicity, and following the reunion, Grace, Lewis, and Ethel were all booked as guests on the popular television show Art Linkletter's House Party. Grace claimed to have no memory of the Babb Switch fire or living with the Edens, but recalled being raised by a woman who was supposedly her mother. However, Grace remembered pushing her away whenever she showed signs of affection, and she said she always had this feeling deep down inside that this woman was not a real mother. When Grace was about 6 or 7, her mother got married to another man, and after that, Grace seemed to live a nomadic lifestyle in which she was passed around through a series of homes in Arkansas and Kansas, though she would periodically be returned to the care of her mother and her stepfather. When Grace was 14 years old and living with a family in Arkansas, her mother wrote her a letter asking if she would like to move to California with her. Grace agreed to make the trip and started school in Los Angeles, but it wasn't long before she drifted apart from her mother and was forced to drop out. According to Grace, she moved in with a Jewish family in North Hollywood and was forced to work for them in exchange for room and board and $15 per month. But Grace eventually moved to San Diego and wound up in the care of a woman named May LaFore, who legally adopted her. Over the years, Grace said that May had attempted to help her find information about her background, but it was not until she was put in touch with the Edens family when she learned her true identity. Shortly before Christmas of 1957, Grace decided to sell her dress shop in Barstow and move with her two sons to Oklahoma, where she would live with various members of the Edens family. Over the next few decades, Grace ran some restaurants in Idaho and Yellowstone Park and eventually got remarried before she settled in Colorado. In 1980, she released a book about her life story titled Mary, Child of Tragedy, The Story of the Lost Child of the 1924 Babswich Fire, though she continued to maintain that she had no memory of her life before the age of 6. Louis Edens died 2 years before the book was released, and Ethel Edens would pass away in 1984. It seemed like the saga of Mary Elizabeth Edens had reached a conclusive ending until a shocking revelation took place in 1999. On Christmas Eve of that year, which happened to be the 75th anniversary of the Babswich Fire, Jay Greeland, a journalist with the Daily Oklahoman newspaper, published an extensive article about the tragedy, which began with this line, quote, "For nearly half a century, the owners of the town's newspaper have known the truth about Louis Edens' missing daughter and never reported it," end quote. The article featured comments from Joe Hancock, the owner of the Hobart Democrat Chief newspaper, who had just revealed a shocking secret in his own paper the previous day. In 1957, Joe's father, Ransom Hancock, owned the Democrat Chief, and shortly after Grace Reynolds reunited with the Edens family, Ransom received evidence that she was not Mary Elizabeth Edens. On February the 19th of that year, only 10 days after the reunion, Mel Bennett, a writer from the Stockton, California-based newspaper The Record, sent a telegram to the Hobart Democrat Chief expressing his belief that Grace Reynolds was an imposter. The Record had recently been contacted by a woman named Dorothy Link, who saw an Associated Press photograph of Grace in the newspaper and recognized her as her own sister. Another woman named Inez Collins would also send out a letter identifying herself as Grace's sister and believed that Grace's decision to pass herself off as a missing child had unfairly painted their mother as a kidnapper. She wrote, quote, "That's the most absurd thing I have ever heard of. I'd like to punch her in the nose," end quote. Mel Bennett wound up working alongside a Democrat chief reporter named Eugene Kuhn to perform a new investigation into Grace's background, and within 3 months, a notarized statement would be obtained from a woman named Goldie Moore, who claimed that Grace was her daughter and had been born on July the 11th, 1923, in Woodruff County, Arkansas, on a farm belonging to Grace's aunt. Grace's sisters believed that she might have intentionally passed herself off as a member of the Edens family, not only because she wanted fame and attention, but because she was ashamed of the fact that her own birth family had been poor. When Eugene Kuhn confronted Grace with all the information that had been uncovered about her past, she continued to maintain that she was Mary Elizabeth Edens, but said she would not make a formal statement until after she consulted with an attorney. The Hobart Democrat Chief and the Stockton Record were both prepared to simultaneously publish stories revealing that Grace was not who she claimed to be, but since Ransom Hancock was friends with Louis Edens, he wanted to share this news with him personally before it went public. However, when Louis was informed that Grace was not actually his daughter, he asked Ransom to keep the whole thing a secret for his wife's sake. Since Ethel had lived with false hope for 3 decades before she finally reunited with a woman she believed was Mary, Louis did not believe she could endure the trauma of losing her child for a second time and would be much happier living with the belief that her daughter was alive. If Ransom still wanted to go public with the information, Louis hoped that he would not do so until after Ethel was dead. Ransom decided to honor Louis's request, so the story about Grace Reynolds never ran in the newspapers, and Ransom put all the evidence he had collected about her into an envelope and kept it inside a safe at his office. Joe Hancock was made aware of this revelation, but even after he took over the Hobart Democrat Chief, he decided to honor his father's wishes and kept this information a secret until 1999. By this point, Louis, Ethel, and Ransom had all passed away, and while Mary's two sisters, Betty and Etta, were still alive, They had found out that Grace was not Mary many years earlier and did not object if the story went public. Grace was also still alive and living in Colorado under her married name, Mary Edens Grossnickel, and when asked to provide comment for the 75th anniversary article, she continued to maintain that she was Mary. Grace believed that Goldie Moore had only provided a notarized statement claiming to be her birth mother because she was scared of being exposed as a kidnapper. Grace passed away in April of 2008 and never wavered from her original story as the name Mary Edens Grossnickel, as well as Mary's original birth date, June the 22nd, 1921, are currently inscribed on her headstone. So after nearly a century, the actual truth about what happened to Mary Elizabeth Edens remains up for debate. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to our sponsor, Faherty. Faherty is a family-run brand making high-quality, timeless clothing with modern design and functionality. I know that Christmas is just around the corner, but it seems like the holiday season starts earlier and earlier every year. However, on this particular year, I'm excited to make up for lost time and all the canceled plans of late. I just moved into a new place last month, but was very excited to be able to decorate it for Christmas in order to get myself into the proper festive spirit. And it was even more satisfying to do this while dressed in my new Faherty brand clothing, which I recently received. If you're searching for the coziest gifts that are practical and stylish, like flannels that seems like you've had them for years, or lush sweaters, festive tops, and dresses that can still be worn after the champagne has been popped, well, Faherty has the options to cover you. In fact, Faherty is so confident in the quality of their clothing that they have a lifetime guarantee of quality. No matter what, they'll replace or fix your clothes forever. I've started wearing the new Faherty clothing I received these past few weeks, and they're so comfortable and stylish that they can be worn during any season, not just the holidays. So if you're looking for a last-minute gift, it's not too late to get your favorite people a Faherty gift card. But don't forget to treat yourself, too. Get 20% off your first purchase by going to FahertyBrand.com/cold and using the promo code COLD at checkout. That's FahertyBrand.com/cold with the promo code COLD at checkout to get 20% off your first purchase. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. Well, other than the disappearance of Ambrose Small, this is the second oldest case I've ever covered on The Trail Went Cold, but I love delving into older mysteries like this because I'm interested in examining how much different the world was during these time periods. The Babb Switch Fire is still considered to be one of the biggest tragedies in the history of Oklahoma, but it was also something of a game changer since it led to a major overhaul in regards to fire safety regulations throughout the United States. The amount of safety hazards at this Christmas party were so absurd that the whole situation might almost be comical if what happened wasn't so horrific. Can you imagine cramming around 200 people inside a 26 by 36 foot schoolhouse where there are lighted candles hanging from the Christmas tree, flammable materials everywhere, and steel grating over the windows? And this is not the only catastrophic fire I've read about from many decades ago, where the building's only doors opened inwards, which caused absolute chaos when everyone panicked and tried to exit all at once. It's incredibly sad that half of the victims in this fire were children, and that entire families were seriously decimated by the tragedy, but the Edens family also had to experience the pain of not actually knowing what happened to their loved one and live with the faint hope that Mary might still be alive somewhere. Now obviously, forensics have advanced so much since 1924 that if an event like this happened today, there might not have been any mystery because they would be able to use DNA testing and other forensic techniques to identify the remains of the victims and determine beyond a shadow of a doubt if Mary died in the fire. Like I mentioned earlier in the episode, at least 20 of the victims were burned beyond recognition, and back then, it would have been impossible to determine which remains belonged to which person. To know who actually died, they pretty much had to use process of elimination by figuring out who was missing, and their deaths would be corroborated by identifying personal items in the ashes which belonged to the victims. While it's possible that some of the remains at the site did belong to Mary, The problem with determining this with 100% certainty is that the locket and the ring she was wearing that night could not be found. And of course, her Aunt Alice claimed she was able to get Mary out of the building through the window and handed the child to an unidentified person. If it wasn't for Alice's story, Mary's family might have accepted that she died in the fire, but because there was no conclusive proof of that, you will not see Mary Elizabeth Edens listed among the 36 victims whose names are inscribed on the memorial monument. When Grace Reynolds was revealed to be the now adult Mary Elizabeth Edens 3 decades later, it was a pretty huge story, but of course if something like that happened today, they'd immediately be able to confirm this with DNA testing. In fact, there have been situations like this during the past few decades where adults have come forward claiming to be missing children, only for DNA testing to rule them out. This option was obviously not available back in 1957, but there were enough similarities between Grace and Mary to convince her family they were the same person. The best forensic option they had at that time was blood testing, which was an effective way to rule out people who were believed to be Mary, but Grace having the same blood type as the Edens family is hardly conclusive evidence they were related. During my intro, I made comparisons to the disappearances of the Sodder children and Joan Gay Croft, but this story is also reminiscent of another case I covered on this podcast about the 1930 disappearance of Mary Agnes Moroney, a 2-year-old girl who was abducted from her family by a woman posing as a social worker. 22 years later, a woman named Mary McClellan came forward who believed that she was Mary Agnes, as she had been adopted by another family about a year after Mary Agnes went missing. A series of experts believed that McClellan had enough genetic similarities to the Moroney family that they became convinced she was Mary Agnes, so the Moroneys accepted her as their daughter. However, after McClellan passed away in 2005, arrangements were made to compare her DNA with surviving members of the Moroney family, and it showed no genetic match. So this meant that McClellan was not Mary Agnes after all, so much like this case, it reverted from being unsolved to solved back to unsolved again several decades after the fact. But the key difference between the two cases is that even though evidence has been publicly presented to show that Grace Reynolds was not Mary Elizabeth Edens, I do not believe any DNA testing has ever been performed. So while it now seems very unlikely that Grace was Mary, they technically haven't proven it with 100% certainty. Now, I will admit that the one thing I did not do while researching this episode was read the book Grace Reynolds published in 1980 titled Mary, Child of Tragedy, The Story of the Lost Child of the 1924 Babswitch Fire, as this book is long out of print and would cost around $100 to purchase a used copy on Amazon. Grace always maintained that she had no memories of anything in her life until about the age of 6, which would have been 3 years after the Babswitch Fire, so the book obviously wouldn't have offered much insight on how her so-called abduction actually took place. But now that we know the truth, I'm sure it would have been a fascinating read, especially if Grace always knew she was orchestrating a hoax and fabricating details to fit her narrative. I also find the timing interesting that Grace started working on the book after Louis Edens passed away in 1978, as he knew she was not actually Mary, and may have objected to Grace's decision to write a book. The way Grace tells it, she was raised by a single mother and had no idea who her biological father was, but once her mother got remarried, she seemed to lose interest in her, and Grace kept being passed around between many different families until a San Diego woman named May LaFore legally adopted her when she was 15. That part of the story does check out, as we know that May LaFore did exist, as newspaper reporting from 1957 states that May reached out to Grace after she discovered she was Mary Elizabeth Edens. Before she was adopted by May, it sounds like Grace did not have the easiest childhood, as she claimed that many of the people she lived with practically treated her as a slave who had to work for her room and board. The official backstory about Grace, which was uncovered by reporters following her reunion with the Edens family, is that her real biological mother was an Arkansas woman named Goldie Moore, and that she was actually 2 years younger than Mary. The people who originally blew the whistle on Grace's background were her 2 biological sisters, Dorothy and Inez, and it sounds like there was some major friction within this family, as Grace's ex-husband had actually been married to Dorothy before he left her to hook up with Grace. While the details of Grace's background are still murky after all these years, I am inclined to agree with the theory that Grace decided to go along with the facade of being Mary Elizabeth Edens because she was ashamed of her roots and might have wanted to attach herself to a less dysfunctional family. Even after this information was made public in 1999, Grace continued to maintain that she was Mary Elizabeth Edens, but it will always be up for debate about whether she legitimately believed this or if she decided to take advantage of the situation because she enjoyed the attention. Remember, it technically wasn't Grace who got herself involved in this story, as this only came about after a friend of hers read about Mary's disappearance and became convinced that Grace was her. It sounds like Grace was never on the best terms with her biological family and was ashamed of the fact that she was born out of wedlock to a single woman who was poor. While the Edens were not wealthy, it still sounds like they were a class above Grace's birth family, so even if she knew the truth about her background and was aware that she was not related to the Edens, Grace may have still elected to go along with the whole narrative once people started believing she was Mary. After all, Grace was the subject of front-page headlines in newspapers all across the United States, and she even got to appear on television, so perhaps she felt this was an opportunity to cut ties with her original roots and make a fresh start, which is why she went along with it. To be fair, it was not Grace who made the decision to come forward, as it was her friend Elmont Place who read a newspaper article about the story and set these events in motion, but Grace may have been more than happy to take advantage of the situation. To me, one of the most remarkable aspects of this whole saga is the restraint shown by Ransom Hancock, the owner of the Hobart Democrat Chief. He received evidence that Grace Reynolds was not Mary Elizabeth Edens, and if he had decided to publish this information, it would have been a pretty huge scoop, since Grace's reunion with the Edens family was a national news story during this time period. However, when Louis Edens asked Ransom not to publish the story because he felt the revelation would be too traumatic for his wife to handle, Ransom respected his wishes and stayed true to his word by taking the secret to his grave. Even though Ransom's son, Joe Hancock, also learned this information at the time and eventually took over the newspaper, he elected not to go public about it for another 4 decades after Louis and Ethel Edens had passed away, and Mary's 2 surviving sisters gave him his blessing. Joe stated that his father's decision to stay silent reflected a humanity that's been lost in modern journalism, and that statement is more true than ever today. If a discovery like this had been made in the era of social media and the 24-hour news cycle, there's no way they would have been able to keep a lid on the secret, and Ethel may have wound up discovering that Grace Reynolds was not her daughter on Twitter. But of course, with today's technology, the story never even would have gotten this far, since DNA testing would have immediately ruled out Grace as being Mary. Even though Louis had noble intentions, by allowing his wife to live with the belief that Mary was still alive, I can only imagine how awkward it must have been for him to live the rest of his life knowing that the woman passing herself off as his daughter was an imposter. It sounds like Mary's 2 sisters, Betty and Etta, both found out the truth sometime during the 1970s, and I get the impression they never had the best relationship with Grace, who would later accuse Betty of being jealous of all the attention she received when she returned to Oklahoma. Apparently, Louis and Ethel did take a trip to California at one point to meet Grace's birth mother and biological sisters, so I wonder if Ethel did find out the truth before she died. During the Daily Oklahoman article from 1999, Etta mentioned that Grace's son Lee, who was just an infant at the time she made contact with the Edens family, still kept in touch with her over the years and called her Aunt Etta, and she still wanted to maintain a relationship with him, even though Lee was technically not her nephew. But Etta said she never had these illusions about Grace, stating, quote, "I am not saying she is an imposter, but I am saying she is not my sister," end quote. Indeed, since Grace wound up being buried under the name Mary Edens Grossnickel, she never stopped maintaining the illusion that this was her true identity. So obviously, if Grace was an imposter, this opens up the question about what actually happened to the real Mary Elizabeth Edens. While I keep making comparisons to the disappearance of Joan Gay Croft, because both these cases involved young children going missing in Oklahoma during terrible disasters which took the lives of several people. However, the key difference is that Joan Gay went missing after the tornado ended, so we know she did not actually perish in the storm, but Mary seemed to disappear while the schoolhouse fire was still raging on. All we know is that Mary was sitting in her Aunt Alice's lap at the time the fire started, and Alice claimed that she managed to break a window and hand Mary to someone standing outside before she climbed out of the building herself, but no one can account for Mary's whereabouts after this. If Alice was telling the truth, and Mary managed to escape the building, then this makes it less likely that she perished in the fire. But the problem is that Alice shared this story while recovering from serious burns in the hospital before she died 2 days later. Given the amount of trauma and pain Alice must have been experiencing at the time, how reliable was her version of events? She probably wasn't very lucid when she told the story, so could she have misremembered the whole thing? To make another comparison to the Sauter children disappearance, one of the more controversial details of that case is the changing story from John Sauter, one of the surviving siblings who managed to escape the house before it burned down. The five children who disappeared were all sleeping in a bedroom in the attic that night, and during his initial police interviews, John claimed that he went into the attic to alert his siblings about the fire before he ran out of the house. However, John later changed his story and claimed that he only called out to his siblings in the attic, but never actually saw them before he left. One theory which has been presented about this discrepancy is that John had survivor's guilt and wished he had done more to save his siblings instead of leaving them behind, which is why he revised that one detail and would no longer acknowledge seeing them in the attic. So perhaps Alice shared a story about helping Mary to safety by handing her to someone out the window, when in actuality, she had no real idea what happened to Mary, and was struggling with guilty thoughts about having possibly left her niece behind to die in the fire. If Alice had managed to survive, it would have been interesting to see if she stuck to her original story or wound up changing details, but given the state she was in, it's difficult to know how reliable her account is. While the Sauter family always held out hope that their missing children were kidnapped, I personally believe that they most likely died in the fire that night, as it seems very unlikely that someone could have snuck into the house in the middle of the night and managed to abduct five children from an attic without being detected. The fire lasted for around 7 hours, and the house contained a large amount of coal, which can make fire burn very hot, and a proper investigation was never performed by the fire marshal's office. Since we're talking about 1945 forensics, it's easy to imagine that the children's remains were burned beyond recognition, and there was just no way to positively identify them. Now, the key difference between this case and the disappearance of Mary Elizabeth Edens is that only one child went missing here, and since we're talking about a chaotic scene where there were a couple hundred people around, it's not completely implausible that someone could have taken Mary away from the scene undetected. But what are the odds that a kidnapper would be around to take advantage of this situation and abduct a child? The kidnapping angle picked up some extra steam in the Sauter case, because there were a lot of strange events which took place that night to suggest that the house fire was a deliberate act of arson. However, there's zero doubt that the Babb switch fire was nothing more than a tragic accident which could not have been predicted, and if Alice's story is accurate, she would have handed Mary out the window maybe a minute or two after the fire started. It would have been an incredibly rotten stroke of luck if Alice just happened to hand the child to someone who turned out to be a kidnapper. Another potential explanation which has been put forward is that Alice did manage to get Mary out of the schoolhouse, but she could have wandered away during the confusion and died of exposure, as Babb Switch is a pretty rural location and it was a very cold night. But a search was performed of the area surrounding the schoolhouse and nothing was found. In the accounts I've read about this case, it's not really clear to me how long it took for Mary's family to notice she was missing. Even though he survived, Lewis Edens actually suffered some pretty serious burns that night, as he heroically went out of his way to help other people out of the schoolhouse and was one of the last survivors to leave the building. Since Lewis had to be rushed to the hospital, I guess it's possible that so much attention was focused on tending to him that Mary was overlooked for several minutes. One hopeful scenario that the Edens family held on to is that Mary was taken by an unknown person who did not do so maliciously. Perhaps this person found Mary wandering around at the site alone, and with all the chaos that was taking place, they were unable to return Mary to her parents. Assuming that her entire family might have been killed in the fire, this new guardian decided to raise Mary as her own child. This does seem like a long shot, but this was rural Oklahoma during the 1920s when information didn't travel as fast, so I guess someone could have taken Mary without ever finding out she was missing and that her family was looking for her. Since the schoolhouse was located fairly close to the highway, a lot of passersby stopped there to offer their assistance when they saw the fire, so there was a lot of traffic that night. Could Mary have been taken by someone who did not even live in the area and subsequently drove her away from the scene? The scenario provided by Grace Reynolds is that she was raised by a woman who lived a nomadic lifestyle and moved around the country a lot, which is why she got the impression this woman wasn't a real mother and she might have been taken from a real family. If something like that did happen to Mary, and she was being raised by an abductor under a false identity, then I suppose this would explain why no one was able to track her down. Mary would have been a young enough age that she would have had no memory of her past life with the Edens. But once again, what are the odds that someone would come across a schoolhouse fire which killed 36 people, and their first instinct would be to abduct a 3-year-old girl, either to harm them or raise them as their own? All that being said, were it not for the surprise development with Grace Reynolds, I'm not sure this story would be looked upon as much of a mystery. When Joe Hancock revealed the truth about Grace in an editorial he published in the Hobart Democrat Chief in 1999, he concluded that in all probability, Mary did die in the fire that night. You have to remember that 20 of the victims had been burned so badly that they could not even properly separate the remains, which is why they were all buried side by side in a mass grave. The main reasons there were some question about whether any of these remains belonged to Mary is because the jewelry she wore that night was not found in the ashes, and Alice's story about getting her out of the building through the window. But I could see Mary's personal items being overlooked at the scene, and Alice's account not being accurate. Of course, since there's no hard evidence that Mary was killed, I will not completely discount the possibility that she could have been abducted by someone. It would ordinarily be hard to believe that a young child like Joan Gay Croft would be taken away from her family by strangers during the aftermath of an F5 tornado, but that's exactly what happened, so anything is possible. Perhaps the only way to conclusively solve this mystery would be to dig up the remains of the victims buried in the mass grave and use DNA testing to determine if any of them have a genetic match to Mary, but I can understand the reluctance to do this after all this time. Every survivor who was present at the Babswich fire has since passed away, so we no longer have any first-hand accounts of what happened that Christmas Eve and figuring out the full truth about what happened. All we can do is honor and respect the memories of the 36 victims who lost their lives in this tragedy, and perhaps one day, Mary Elizabeth Edens will officially be recognized as victim number 37. But if by some chance you happen to have any information to suggest that Mary did not actually die in the fire that night, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Katie Stanko for narrating the opening of this episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. I just released a bonus episode about a controversial unsolved mysteries case about a missing Marine named Kurt Borton, who was supposedly killed in action during the Vietnam War, but his family became convinced he survived and returned to the United States. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unsolved 1971 disappearance of Lynn Schulze, whose case has been linked to recently convicted murderer Robert Durst. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Justin W. and Melter Skelter. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to get a discount. So to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's crimecon.com and the promo code is TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which has an interesting discussion thread about today's featured case. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the ear music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So this is our final episode before the Christmas holidays, but it's not our final episode of the year, as next Wednesday, we will be concluding 2021 with a special update episode in which I talk about some cases featured on this podcast which have since been solved or had major developments. So we hope you all have a safe and happy holidays, and join us next Wednesday for our update episode of The Trail Went Cold.